Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. This is Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. Today, Perry Little and I are going to go through another YouTube video by Harrison Cother. This is the ex-Jehovah Witness turned atheist, and he called his video Noah's Ark, the story that disproves the entire Bible. Now, this particular video of his has over 1 million views, and this is just since March. So this should be interesting. Anyways, please welcome back to the show Perry Little from New Brunsfels, Texas, just outside of San Antonio.
Thanks, Fred, for having me back.
That's great to have you back. Again, last week's show was a lot of fun. Before we get into this next video, I wanted to mention a news item. NASA is launching its Webb space satellite in 6 days. You can go to the NASA website and look up the Webb satellite, and they got a countdown going. So this is supposedly going to be able to look back 13.7 billion years to just after the Big Bang. So this allows us to make another RSR prediction, and this one is like taking candy from a baby, namely that the early baby galaxies will be actually spiral galaxies that are fully formed, codgers, if you will, and not infant galaxies. Astronomers are repeatedly startled and baffled by these kind of findings, and you can learn more about the Big Bang and the evidences against it at rsr.org/Big Bang. Okay, so we're going to get back to the video by the ex-Jehovah Witness. And before I do that, actually, I wanted to raise an important point that I've been thinking about since the last show, Perry. I'm guessing you've experienced the same thing. In the years of that I've debated, not just evolutionists, but also old Earth Christians, I would commonly hear that you can't expect scientifically minded people to believe in the gospel if you tell them that the earth is young. And that's because of all the indoctrination that they've gotten through public schools and the media, museums, etc.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yep. You know, for example, Deborah Harsma, the president of BioLogos. Now, this is a group started by Francis Collins, who's a theistic evolutionist, said that science doesn't have to drive people away from faith. Well, in a way, we agree. Real science should actually drive people to a stronger faith. It's just that she assumes her view of science is correct.
Right.
And, you know, Perry, from last week, it was the ex-Jehovah Witness Harrison Cother's assumption that secular science was correct that ironically led him to atheism and not biblical Christianity after he left the Watchtower.
Yeah, that's right, Fred. Like most ex-JWs, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, including myself, when we leave the Watchtower organization, most of us take our belief in billions of years that the Watchtower taught us with us. At least in my case, I think most people's cases, it never occurs to most ex-JWs that maybe they should research this Watchtower teaching along with all the other ones that they found to lack support. This belief in deep time really opens the door to belief in evolution because you seemingly now have death before sin in the fossil record. And we discussed that extensively last week. But since the Bible says that sin brought death and not the other way around, well, the next step is rejecting the biblical history altogether. So, yeah, it's a big problem.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, so their foundation was built on sand, and it made it easier for him to leave that faith. So I found this quote from USA Today that ironically and unwittingly makes our point on how the wrong assumptions of science actually leads to disbelief, not belief, as this BioLogos group tries to argue. So from USA Today, creationists will believe what they want to believe, but they should know the consequences. Continued fighting to promote creationism is hurting religion's credibility in an age when science and technology are perceived as reliable sources of truth and positive contributors to society. Anecdotal and polling evidence implicate religion's anti-science, notice how they say anti-science, reputation in the drift away from church involvement, especially among younger adults, nearly 40% of whom have left organized religion behind. You know, this is really kind of one of the arguments made by Ken Ham in his book Already Gone. And it's, you know, so many students in school, even by middle school, they're already leaving the faith just because they're being indoctrinated with millions of years, which is obviously a contradiction to the Bible. It makes it more difficult to believe it. So ironically, Perry, it sounds like the USA Today in this case is making our point for us unwittingly.
Yes. In fact, the last sentence is ironically true. If you agree with Real Science Radio that the secular view on origins is anti-science, and we do live in an age where more and more science, supposed science, is coming under a lot of scrutiny, things like confirmation bias. I mean, there was one study that said that a great percentage of the peer-reviewed papers weren't even true. So I think science itself is coming under a lot of scrutiny here lately.
Yeah, so let me reread the USA Today quote again, but this time I'm going to substitute anti-science with belief in evolution and millions of years.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, this to help drive the point home. Anecdotal and polling evidence implicate religion's belief in evolution in millions of years in the drift away from church involvement, especially among younger adults, nearly 40% of whom have left organized religion behind. And it's because of this belief in millions of years in evolution. So yeah. The main point is this. Christians who argue that belief in a young earth leads people away from the faith are really totally blind to the fact that they have it completely backwards, as this USA Today article and the ex-Jehovah Witness Harrison Cawther ironically prove. If you believe the secular view of science and accept millions of years and evolution, it will likely steer you away from the Bible and faith.
Absolutely. I've thought that for years. It's ridiculous to think otherwise. You know, Fred, if evolution and millions of years is true, then there isn't a logical reason to believe the Bible. Many atheists understand this. And I have a quote from G. Richard Bosworth, who wrote the following in the magazine American Atheist. And listen to this. He says, Christianity has fought, still fights, and will fight science to the desperate end over evolution, because evolution destroys utterly and finally the very reason Jesus' earthly life was supposedly made necessary. Destroy Adam and Eve and the original sin, and in the rubble, you will find the sorry remains of the Son of God, taking away the meaning of his death. If Jesus was not the Redeemer that died for our sins, and this is what evolution means, then Christianity is nothing, end of quote.
Yep, exactly. I mean, so the atheists often understand the problem much more than Christians do. And you know, Perry, I've always been a science guy in the sense that if the evidence is strong, that's the way I'll go. I know that I would not believe the Bible if there really was evidence for evolution in millions of years, because if true, it would contradict the very first chapters in the Bible. I use the following analogy in one of my talks. One of my nephews is an absolute expert in warplanes, especially from World War II. So imagine he's in a library and he finds a book on warplanes. It's got really neat pictures and whatnot, and he's excited to open up and read it. But on the very first several pages, he sees pictures of UFOs and George Jetson's airplane. So I'm probably dating some people by going back to that cartoon. So he knows from the get-go that the book is, you know, basically ridiculous. So he just puts it back. So how is that different if you believe in millions of years, then read the historical account of Genesis over literal 24-hour days in a global flood? You know, why believe anything else in the Bible if you can't trust the first few chapters? The very foundation of the Bible. It is as the verse in Psalm 11:3 says, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? So Perry, wow. We at RSR are here to defend the foundation of the Bible. And it's interesting, at the end of his video, you'll see how he pulls his piece of wood and all the foundation above it comes tumbling down. And so hopefully that makes the point of why this is so important to, you know, Christians to understand where the battle is.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Fred. When I left the Watchtower and their teachings on billions of years, I took the time to carefully research every claim that secularists and atheists make against the Bible. And I'll be honest with you, I was a little scared where it might lead me. I had no idea. But my fear of being fooled again was greater than my fear of the unknown. And that search ended up leading me to a faith in the Creator, Jesus Christ, whom scriptures say all things were created by him. So let's go ahead and listen to the first clip if you're ready.
Yeah, let's do it.
Over the next couple of months, I would go on to research every single drop of evidence put forward to support the Bible story as being historically true. I would then reread the Bible account and address very important questions that had popped up into my mind over the process. A process of which optimism turned to skepticism, turned to mental despair. How through isolating and dissecting just one Bible story sent the infallibility of the entire Bible crashing down.
Yep. So, and there he pulls a piece of wood out of, I guess it's called Jenga is the name of the game, and all these pieces of wood above it come crumbling down. So right away, it's just what we're talking about. He believes by proving the global flood is false, it's going to knock down the entire Bible. He's attacking a foundational truth found in the early chapters of the Bible. Again, those Christians who believe we can compromise and accept his and the secular world's interpretation of the evidence fail to realize they are playing right into the hands of the atheists and are in fact making it harder for a person to hold a reasonable faith.
I agree. Also, did you notice the picture of the ark he has in the video on his back wall? It's like a storybook version for children with large animals sticking their head out of portholes in a odd-shaped boat. But in reality, the dimensions, and the Bible is very clear about the dimensions,
yep,
especially the ratio between the width and the length of the ark as it's given in the Bible, those are ideal for ship stability. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we really think the pictures that they should have of ark should be realistic of what the ark really would have looked like, or, you know, at least dimension-wise. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I know South Korean ship architects some time ago, they showed that the dimensions of the ark are so ideal for stability that even the world's worst tsunami that we've had could not capsize it.
Wow. You know, if you think about it, if a literal flood argument was only made of quotations from the Bible, then he is right in some of his reasoning. Quotations from the Bible would not be persuasive if that's all we had, mm-hmm, any more than the scores of atheists who tell people that evolution is true because their favorite book or author claims it's true.
Yep. Okay, let's continue with the video.
But why I love this story so much is because faith doesn't need to enter into the picture. If it's true that only 4,300 years ago, there was a global flood which destroyed anything and everything in its path, excluding just an ark of animals and 8 humans, then the evidence will be overwhelming. We know there was a global flood because the Bible clearly teaches it as a factual event. To anyone well-versed in logical fallacies, this is a clear example of circular reasoning. We know it's true because the Bible says it's true. It's like a Muslim saying, we know the Prophet Muhammad was a messenger of the true God because the Quran teaches it as fact. Or a Hindu saying, we know that Lord Shiva brought his beheaded son back to life because the Vedas teaches it as a factual event. The problem on all three accounts is that if you don't share the same presuppositions as the one saying it, it's completely ineffective reasoning.
You know, Perry, of course he left out that part that most science professors drive a VW bus and eat tofu, you know.
Oh, stop it, Fred.
You know, we are driven by our suppositions, but so is he.
I agree.
You know, we as biblical creationists, we're not trying to convince atheists by saying the Bible says it's so. We instead, as people know from, you know, years of doing Real Science Radio, we appeal to actual scientific evidence.
Absolutely. We all have access to the same science, but what differs is how we interpret it. Also, I wanted to bring out, you notice his reference to faith. His version of faith is not the Bible's version.
Exactly.
Faith in Hebrews 11:1 says that it's the evidence of things not seen. So Christians are not trying to just bring some empty words on a page as evidence. We want to bring actual scientific evidence to the table. The Bible says that real faith must have corroborating evidence. So this is the same method that forensic researchers use in determining causation. And it's very powerful evidence in a court where things like liability, guilt, and innocence are regularly determined in courts today.
Yeah, what a great point.
What I was looking for was evidence that could not be refuted. And I thought I found just that. On page 328 of the Insight book produced by Jehovah's Witnesses, I found a list of flood legends sourced from all over the world, which on average share 4 out of the 6 basic similarities that the biblical flood story contains. How can so many flood legends exist that share such common features with the biblical one? As Noah's descendants spread throughout the earth, it seems that they retold the story of the flood. In time, however, the story evidently became distorted into various forms. The first time I saw this, it kind of made sense, especially considering what happened at the Tower of Babel. Over time, the story was retold and retold until it got distorted into various forms. But when I broke down the exact categories, the locations, and the details of these specific floods, that hypothesis began to fall apart. I first thought it was bizarre how Watchtower included the category destruction by water. Now correct me if I'm wrong, but I've never seen a major flood that hasn't brought some level of destruction by water. This would be the equivalent of me doing a table to find humans similar to myself and including the box human. One aspect that was more surprising to me though was that only half of these flood legends were of divine cause. Considering how in the biblical account, God warns Noah, God provides the specific building dimensions of the ark, God brings the animals, God brings the rain, God shuts the door, God approves of Noah's post-flood sacrifices. God plays a massive role in this story. But in almost half of these legends found all over the world, a god or gods don't even feature.
So Perry, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's, you know, a really weak argument, to be quite frank.
Yep.
First, he admits that half of all flood accounts around the world do reference God, but somehow the half that doesn't proves it's all made up. That just doesn't make sense. Why is one side proof and the other not proof? I would actually have expected more than half of flood accounts would leave out the part about God's judgment. I mean, if you think about it, no unbeliever, either ancient or today, wants to believe that God could judge an entire world. I mean, that's just such a downer.
Yeah, exactly.
If this hypothesis was true, that the prevalence of flood legends derives from a singular event in Genesis, then we would expect these legends to exist irrespective of their location. You would find some on islands, some being told by people who live in a country which borders the sea, and some being told by people who live 1,000 miles inland. But as you go through the list, one by one you notice that nearly all of these legends are from islands or countries which border the sea. And in the odd case you think they're not, a small amount of research into the people and the tribes to which these flood legends derive reveal at one time they lived either by the sea or by major rivers.
Wow. So first off, notice how when he admits he finds examples of those not near a sea, they, guess what, happen to live near a river. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
I think that he's forgetting that all people must find water to survive, at least the nearby river.
Right.
So he's basically claiming that you can't believe these accounts unless you can find a group of people with a flood account who chose to live in an inland desert without water. Of course, this mythical type of people group is virtually unheard of. His argument really is very unconvincing. We had a speaker in back in May 2021 at our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship group at youngearth.org, and you can go listen to his video there. It's called The Red Record and the Delaware Indian Account, and it's amazing how similar their stories and their writings were that support a global flood, not some local catastrophic flood, but really a global flood.
I mean, everybody, every civilization in history, you know, you want to set up something next to a water source. So he put the bar so high, there's no way you could ever reach it.
Yeah.
Still largely unsatisfied, I would go on to read 6 books front to back, 2 DVDs, and do extensive research online, analysing the best evidence people put forward for the flood happening. From woolly mammoths frozen in time, to the Genesis flood being revealed in Chinese picture symbols, and remnants of marine life being found near the summit of some of the world's tallest mountains. Time and time again, the recurring problem that I encountered with these pieces of apparent evidence was the fact that they couldn't be scientifically reinforced as fact. They were simply speculation and assertions.
Yeah, those are actually really good pieces of evidence for a global flood that he mentions.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we do find marine fossils on every major mountain range all over the world, including Mount Everest. Yet he dismisses this evidence as just assertions.
Yeah, this is a real important point in the video. He's dismissing really powerful evidence for a global flood as just speculation and assertion. You know, nobody disputes that we find these marine fossils on mountain ranges. And there, we always find them in the closed position too, which means they were buried alive. You know, when you go to if you go to the beach and you, you know, everybody likes to grab the, you know, the shells off the beach that, you know, we brought them back to our hotel room the first time we took our kids to the beach. And it, we noticed things started to stink a little bit, you know, that seafood smell. And it was because the ones that were in a closed position, those guys were actually still alive. And now they're sitting there rotting in our sink in the hotel room. So the point is, a lot of these are buried in the closed position, which means they were buried alive and catastrophically. You can go to Home Depot, and in their gravel, you can find marine life. And as Ken Ham famously said, if there was a global flood, we'd expect to see billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth, and that's exactly what we see. But yet again, he completely dismisses this as an assertion, and then that's it. He doesn't bring it up again. It's a clear case of making up your mind despite the evidence.
Yeah, it's a great example of all of us having the same evidence, but getting a different conclusion based on our presuppositions.
Exactly.
Just as a side note, the ancient Chinese characters that he brought up is a great study. I think listeners should Google this on YouTube, how the ancient Chinese characters really have many elements of the story of the biblical flood encapsulated and enshrined right there in their ancient Chinese characters.
Yeah, and you know, it reminds me of, you know, one of them is eight people boat. It's like you take these three symbols and you put them together and that forms the word for ship. Well, I mentioned that in a talk once. Actually, it was at a Bible study, and this lady who had been studying over in China, and she lived there for like 10 years. So she spoke fluent Chinese, and she's like, oh, that's not true. That eight, that's not the Chinese symbol for eight. And I'm like, okay, you know, I wasn't sure. So I'm like, okay, let me look into that. Well, I happened to just start working at Trimble, and my boss was Chinese. I asked her, is this the symbol for eight? And she goes, no. So right away, I'm like, oh. And then she goes, but it used to be.
You have to go back to the very first Chinese characters that they use, not the more modern ones.
Exactly. And you know, just like our language, try to read an old King James, an original King James, it's really hard to read. I mean, our language has changed a lot too. Right. You could almost say our language de-evolves, other than, you know, we add words to it like internet and dinosaur.
It's a fascinating study, and our listeners should Google that and do their own research.
Yep.
But just when I thought that I'd exhausted all lines of evidence, I was about to hear of something which, if true, would be a complete game changer. Because when I went to see a couple in the family, and I told them that the story of Noah's Ark was one of the key reasons as to why I was having doubts in my faith, they looked at me completely bemused and they said, Well, Haz, what do you mean? They have found Noah's Ark. I'm not sure what they'd been looking at, but it certainly wasn't JW.org. Even the website says that numerous expeditions have led to interesting claims, but not to conclusive proof. And that despite many efforts, though, the search for Noah's Ark is ongoing.
You know, he's right that Noah's Ark hasn't been found. And personally, I believe it won't be found. I mean, it would be cool if it was, but it wouldn't change his mind even if it was found, because for atheists and, you know, unbelievers, often it isn't a matter of evidence, as our show has really proven through the years.
Right. It's more of a matter of interpretation.
Yep. And then just your own suppositions and what you want to believe. So this also reminds me of Luke chapter 16, verse 31, when Jesus said, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead.
Right.
After Noah reached 500 years of age, he became father to Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This was the first red flag that I encountered, and it's before the flood story even begins. If I wanted to maintain my belief that this story was true, I'd also have to believe that in a world before contraception, in a world in which Noah and his wife probably got married as soon as their bodies were physically able to, they were having intimate moments for around 480 years without bearing a child. And then bam, there's three all at once.
So Perry, again, that's a pretty weak argument. Just assuming that, you know, they would have been able to have kids right away. We don't know. There's obviously cases we know of.
We don't know how long childhood lasted, how long adolescence lasted. We know of couples today that can't have kids and then you know, years and years later, suddenly they have a child. So this really doesn't prove anything.
Oh, exactly.
Assuming that there were roughly the same number of species at the time of the flood as to today, the total figure for the number of animals on board the Ark would stand at approximately 2.065 million. 2.065 million is a figure that to many Christians sounds far too high. But bear in mind that that figure doesn't include the thousands of species that have gone extinct between the Ark finishing its voyage to today, and the fact that Noah was actually instructed by God to take seven of many species and not two. If the Genesis story is correct, when it says that they boarded on that very day, the animals would have had to board the Ark at the rate of 50 per second. Even without insects, Noah would have still needed to board the animals at a rate of 3 every 2 seconds. Unless Jehovah provided a high-speed conveyor belt to help the animals along onto the Ark, this would have been impossible. But using that figure of 2.065 million, I was rather dubious as to whether all these animals would have even been able to fit on board the Ark. And after doing the necessary calculations, let's just say that the animals would have become very familiar with each other.
Okay, so here he's doing the classic assuming species instead of kinds of animals. You know, Perry, right. We've got like, I think 17 different North American jackrabbit species. Well, guess what? You don't need all those species on the Ark. You just need one. And the only reason they were classified as a different species is because they don't interbreed. But as it turns out, if you put those jackrabbits together over time, they figure it out how to interbreed with each other.
Right.
So,
yeah, I mean, we've had recent studies like on Darwin's finches. Some finches were left on an island for only 17 years, and not millions of years. Within those 17 years, they developed variations in beaks and different attributes. So the genome is incredibly complex and already has all this information. It just expresses itself in different ways, you know, based on a variety of factors. That's the genius of God's creative ability.
Yeah, boy, what a great point. And, you know, he knows about the whole creationist argument from using kinds of animals because he mentions it later. So what annoys me is he spent a fair amount of his video disingenuously, frankly, still presenting this argument. You know, and I like this guy. He's battling the Jehovah's Witness Watchtower, so that we have in common.
Right.
But honestly, this on his part was just an intellectual, it was really an intellectually dishonest argument because he knows that we don't agree with this and we have a solid answer for it that he mentions later.
But I was forgetting one very important factor. Noah was instructed to collect and take enough food to last his family and every single animal on board for a time period which lasted over a year. Mr. and Mrs. Elephant require, on average, 600 pounds of food between them each day. That's the same weight as a 5x5 round bale of hay. They would therefore have required the equivalent weight in food of 370 bales of hay during the trip. That's around 222,000 pounds.
Wow. Yeah, he assumes Noah would have taken full-grown animals, such as elephants and dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Like the ones in his picture on his back wall.
Yeah, for the children's illustration. The average size of a dinosaur is that of a dog. The size of a baby elephant is pretty small. There would have been plenty of room for storage, plus plenty of types of animals that we know of hibernate. God could have caused more animals to hibernate. We just don't know. So he's presenting an assertion and an assumption. And I would recommend people read the book Noah's Ark, A Feasibility Study, for additional information.
Yeah, it's an excellent book from John Woodmeramp. He assumes like you'd take full-grown, like dinosaurs. You wouldn't need to. You just take the, you could, why couldn't you take juvenile or baby dinosaurs? Why take the codgers?
Right.
And I should provide a big warning at this point. If you possess even the slightest amount of knowledge of the animal kingdom, the natural world, and the theory of evolution, and not from religious organizations' publications, then you may want to look away now. Under the heading, Could the Ark Have Held All the Animals?, the Insight book says, it is true that encyclopedias refer to over a million species of animals, but Noah was instructed to preserve only representatives of every kind of land animal and flying creature. That means just 43 kinds of mammals, 74 kinds of birds, and 10 kinds of reptiles could have produced the great variety of species of these creatures that are known today. They assert that within the space of only 4,300 years, 43 kinds of mammals have evolved into over 5,500 species. One kind of monkey got off the ark. 4,300 years later, we now have over 330 species of monkey. According to that evolutionary rate of 1 into 330, if we were to travel 4,300 years into the future, we would witness a world plagued by 108,900 species of monkey. What is the most unbelievably ironic thing here is that this organization takes every opportunity to slate and rubbish the theory of evolution. But when they need it to make the numbers of this story even remotely possible, they assert the most aggressive and rapid form of evolution imaginable.
Yeah, so we heard the part where he recognizes that, hey, we actually believe it's kinds of animals off the ark. And then, as you mentioned, there's great genetic variation. And we've seen evidence of that all over the planet. And you mentioned Darwin's finches. So then when he mentions how we use fast evolution, or really microevolution, he's doing what we call on my evolutionfairytale.com forum. It's called equivocation. And it's an extremely common ploy used by evolutionists. It's right out of their playbook. And what truly is ironic is evolutionists will claim that small-scale adaptation is proof of evolution. And that's where they really equivocate. And basically, they came up with the word microevolution, and it gives the illusion that evolution is true, since everyone agrees that adaptation occurs. Everybody agrees in their what they call microevolution.
Right.
But this does not prove what they want you to believe, which is macroevolution, or molecules to man, which not a shred of evidence supports large-scale evolution. So they blur the line between small-scale change and large-scale change. Perry, I'm sure you've heard this argument before, because I've heard it a zillion times about how microevolution proves macroevolution.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that I noticed when I was a Jehovah's Witness, how the Watchtower would use definitions of words that other people didn't have. And so it created a lot of confusion. It served to kind of compartmentalize people's thinking. And I'm just thinking of the word, like the word or the phrase theoretical science. You know, when we think of the word science, we think of the scientific method and being able to test things and replicate results. But theory is something that is outside of the laboratory and can't be replicated. And so when you put those two words together, theoretical science, it sounds like, oh, well, they figured out a way to prove something. So by fusing the concept of theory and science, it can give the impression that both are provable using the scientific method. That's just one example. So we have to be very careful about definitions. We have to be methodical in how we use information so that we don't box ourselves in mentally.
Exactly.
Well, fortunately, we live in a time period where we don't have to take any one person's word that the story is true. We don't even have to take the Bible at face value, because there is a foolproof method of determining whether the story is historically sound. What we can do is we can analyze the geographical dispersity of animal species across the entire planet. In theory, the closer you get to Mount Ararat in Turkey and its surrounding countries, the more numerous and more varied the life forms will be. The further away you get from that focal point, the less numerous and less varied the animal life will be.
So this was his foolproof method of disproving the story.
Yeah, that's a pretty lame argument. He makes an assumption already disproven by even his own secular science many times over. Biodiversity is dependent on environmental factors by location, not current weather conditions around Mount Ararat.
Exactly. Earlier, he had pictures of some books he went through from creationists. Too bad he didn't have Walt Brown's book in there. You know, I'd highly recommend Harrison, if you ever listen to this, get Walt Brown's book in the beginning. And one of the things he mentions is the land bridges that were clearly there at one time, and it would explain how, you know, animals were able to, for example, get to Australia. So anyways, we sell that book, by the way, Harrison, at rsr.org/store.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book by a prominent science and researcher, and I highly recommend it as well.
And so what do they do? Well, they have one final trick stored up their sleeve just for this occasion. Jesus, Paul, and Peter accepted the flood as historical and used it as a warning. Jesus Christ plainly stated, "Noah entered into the ark and the flood arrived." This is the best evidence possible. Jesus was in heaven before he came to earth. He watched the building of the ark. He saw the flood. When considered from that standpoint, the evidence that Noah's Ark existed is already overwhelming. Or as my dad put it, are you calling Jesus Christ a liar?
You know, Perry, actually, I think his dad had a good point. If Jesus is who he claims to be, and the evidence supports that, then it would be important to take his word as evidence. And we could do a long show on the historicity of Jesus. I have a quick read on this at my BibleEvidences.com website on the historicity of Jesus. And the fact that Jesus refers to the flood as real history and as a, you know, as a global flood, it means Christians who believe in Christ should take him at his word. And it's not that, again, it's not because we just believe it, just have a faith in Jesus. You know, faith is the evidence of things not seen. Every house has a builder. And we know from evidence that Jesus is who he claims to be.
I mean, how can we take his words as symbolic that are so clear the way he phrased them? You know, the evidence for the resurrection is substantial. Dr. Yep. Gary Habermas has identified 12 facts regarding the resurrection in his minimal facts argument that even atheist skeptics concede to. I encourage everyone to look that up. And if the best conclusion from these facts that even skeptics agree to is that Jesus was raised from the dead, well, you just have to take seriously what a man has to say that claims he would die and then resurrect himself.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and Bob always made the great argument, too, that every day atheists and unbelievers and believers around the world are a testimony to the truth of Jesus' history by, you know, like when they sign a check or they're, you know, they put the date on any document they're working on. As an engineer, you know, maybe I'll put a date on a document or you say what time it is. I mean, everything goes back to the birth of Christ. You know, our calendars right. All, there's a few remote, some of just a very small handful of really pagan countries that don't use the calendar. But hey, the calendar is based on the birth of Jesus Christ, a real person, real in history. And as you mentioned, even atheists admit, history professors who are the most liberal in the world admit that Jesus was a real person. If they don't, they're a quack. I mean, frankly, they're not taken seriously.
Absolutely. I mean, what would cause thousands upon thousands of fundamental Jews to stop celebrating the Sabbath on a Saturday and make Sunday their holy day right in the heart of Judaism, the city of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, unless Jesus came back from the dead? That's just one of the evidences. So you have to believe a man who comes back from the dead. You have to take him seriously.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, talking about, you know, taking Jesus at his word, I used to be in this thing called, it's called Bible Study Fellowship. It's actually a pretty decent program. I did it for a couple of years. And one of the guys in it, he was a believer in Christ, and he believed Jesus because the evidence is overwhelming, and he became a believer, so he's taken Jesus at his word. Well, when it came to the scientific evidence for the global flood and things like that, he found it interesting, but he said the number one reason he became a believer in a young earth was the death before sin issue, because it's so clear in the Bible that the result of death is because of man's sin. Yet if there's millions of years of death, disease, suffering, cancer, all these things in the fossil record, if you believe in millions of years of that, then, you know, death came before sin. And then that's, again, where you mentioned earlier that comment, that quote by Bozarth, the atheist. Atheists understand the problem better than we do.
Many times that's true, yes.
Yep. So on this last clip we're going to play, I want the audience to notice how he refers to the flood as a foundational piece, which he's correct about. And if you knock that piece down, everything crumbles after it. So this is a good lesson for many Christians who compromise on Genesis and the damaging effects it has.
When it touches on science or history, it is always 100% accurate, guaranteed. And yet, as one of the foundation pieces of this book, there is quite a fallacious story, an obvious mythological adaptation. The fact that the rest of the Bible, including apparently the words of Jesus Christ himself, refer to this story as being true, simply disproves my claim that it is inspired and infallible. In other words, my whole tower of faith did this.
So you can watch that video. We'll provide a link to his video. But again, it goes back to Psalm 11, chapter 11, verse 3. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do?
Right. That sound that we heard is he pulls a piece out of the bottom of that stack of wood, the Jenga puzzle, and it all comes crumbling down. So it's a perfect illustration of why compromising with the secular world driven by men is not really a good idea. The center verse of all this is Psalms 118:8.
Oh, one of my favorite verses. Yep.
Yeah. It's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. Now, when I had left Jehovah's Witnesses, I tell you, when I put trust in myself, my life instantly became quite a bit better. But it wasn't until I put trust in God alone that my life really took off in every possible way.
Yep. So, Perry, we're actually out of time. You finished the video. Man, it was great having you go through this video by Harrison Cawther. Over 1 million views on this thing, and that's just since March. So I'm hoping people will be able to listen to our radio show and understand why his video is just full of things that aren't true. You know, it's we made a strong case as to why you can actually trust the Bible and the foundation of the Bible.
Absolutely. I enjoyed you having me on, Fred.
Yep, we'll definitely do this again. And so, by the way, please support us by going to rsr.org/store. We've got tons of great material, and you can even become a sponsor of a show, which would be really cool. We're getting people to sponsor shows, and that's really neat. So for Real Science Radio, I'm Fred Williams. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.